I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Students and teachers are back in school after the winter break, while the school district continues to struggle with fewer staff, less money, and an uncertain future. There has been little or no movement on the teacher contract. Governor Corbett is looking for a new head of the School Reform Commission, and schools are feeling the impact of cuts in the number of counselors, nurses, librarians, and support staff. Our guests have been following the education crisis in Philadelphia, and they'll get us up to speed on what's been happening inside the schools, inside City Council in Harrisburg, and at the SRC. And let me introduce the three of them to you. Kristen Graham is education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, won a Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for her reporting. She also writes the Philly School Files blog. And Kristen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Also with us is Dale Mezzacapa. She's been covering education since the mid-1980s. She's currently contributing editor at the Philadelphia Public School Notebook. That's an independent and nonprofit publication, sharing partnership with WHYY. And Dale, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you in. Rounding out our trio of guests is Kevin McCrory. He covers education for Newsworks and WHYY. And Kevin, nice to have you back as well.
Great to be here, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Kristen. And I remember doing shows over the summer in anticipation of the new school year, concerns about overcrowded classrooms, not enough staff, even questions about safety, materials for children. Did that pan out this year?
Well, there definitely have been wide-ranging implications of the budget crisis. You know, certainly anecdotally you hear from teachers, students, parents that there are fewer adults in schools, and that definitely leads to safety concerns. Overcrowding was more of a concern earlier in the year. The district does a process called leveling, which it did late this year, but essentially created some bringing new teachers in and sending teachers out where there were excess teachers. So there still are some overcrowded classes you hear from teachers every now and again. There are also some split classes where you have two grades in one elementary school classroom, which is a real concern for a lot of parents.
Well, from your perspective, Dale?
Yeah, I would agree with Kristen. She's done a lot of really good reporting on the ground in the schools, as has Kevin, relating to the lack of, or certainly the dearth of, adults in schools. So that means that it's harder for teachers to concentrate on teaching. There's a lot more instability. Principals have to do a million other things besides try to be instructional leaders. Supplies, who's in charge of those? Is there enough equipment around? What's getting repaired? What's not getting repaired? A computer breaks down, nobody fixes it, and then, you know, the whole class is disrupted. So it's not a pretty situation.
Kevin, you did a story last night about security, safety guards at sporting events at a high school in Philadelphia.
Right, and that's just a small example, right? But it's, I guess, indicative of the problem. Here we are. You would think it's a high school basketball game. You're going to be able to have fans come to the game. That's an automatic. But somehow in the Philadelphia School District, no, that's not an automatic. Because if you can't pay the $90 it costs to get two security guards there for an hour and a half after the game, you know, it's...
You can't play?
Well, they can play the game. You just can't have fans watch the game. Right?
So. As an example.
That's just a small example, right? That's not a tremendous piece. But, you know, to go with Dale and Kristen, we're saying it's the haves and have-nots across the district, right? It's the schools. Everybody's trying to maintain. Everybody's stretched thin. There's some schools that are able to do it better, maybe because they're... parental resources are stronger, or because their leadership is stronger. But everybody's certainly trying. That's what you hear from teachers. You hear, we have to do the jobs of 10 other people. The principal has to do the job of a dozen other people. And it kind of gets to this point of, are we actually improving in this climate, right? I was talking to a principal the other day who said, you know, there's this Race to the Top initiative to try to have us evaluate our staff at a higher level. We have no time to implement it. I have no time to sit down and learn this new computer system where, you know, I can actually give feedback to teachers and actually improve this system.
There's actually new rules, Dale, that the state is mandating regarding teacher evaluation. And it's going to be much, much harder for Philadelphia principals to implement, though it's not just Race to the Top. It's like this is what's required now in terms of evaluation of teachers. And not to mention the Common Core standards and the Keystone exams and new curriculum that districts are supposed to follow, theoretically, because they're more rigorous. What's the supports to help the schools, to help the students meet the standards, is very little.
Kristen, you've been in classrooms, and there are, you know, many of them in the city, but how are teachers coping with these stresses?
Well, I recently spent time at Kensington High School for the Creative and Performing Arts, which is a neighborhood high school, takes all comers, and, you know, was just struck at how hard all adults are working in the building and the jobs that they're being required to do. As Kevin and Dale alluded to, the principal at one point, at actually several points during the day, basically had to stop what she was doing and go and act as a hall monitor. And that's, you know, not the best use of her time, but there was simply no one else to keep order in the hallways because those resources have been taken away from schools. You talk to teachers, you know, they've always been spending, you know, hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars out of their pockets to, you know, fund their classroom, you know, to provide proper supplies. I talked to one teacher at Kensington Kappa who said he was spending $1,300. He spent $1,300 last year. He expected to spend much more this year. People are tired. They're, you know, certainly, they don't want kids to go without, and so they're stepping up to the plate. But I heard from a number of teachers who said, I don't know how long I can sustain this. Mm. This is not, you know, they're just, they're
financially,
really
tired. Psychologically, everything?
Psychologically, absolutely.
I'm curious about whether, looking at City Council, the School Reform Commission, Dale, whether there's a sense of urgency about trying to deal with some of these pressing issues here in the district.
Well, I think that in terms of the political leadership of Harrisburg and City Hall, there has not been a sense of urgency that things are falling apart. There's been a lot of conflict between the two when the school district knew it was facing this huge shortfall in funds, and it had a plan to deal with it, which was to get $180 million from the state and the city and $133 million in labor concessions. The state came up with a plan. The city came up with a plan, but it has not resulted. They're at odds over how to raise the money. The state told the city to raise the sales tax and count it as the state share. The city had the idea of having the, or extending the increase in the sales tax to use it for pensions. So city council, they're disagreeing. The state wanted the city to borrow money off the future revenue, and Darryl Clark, the city council president, said no. And
he wants to sell the
school district. He wants to sell school district properties and use that money instead rather than incurring any more debt. But what's happening is that you have this battle going on between Harrisburg and Philadelphia over how to raise the money and whose money it is and all this. And what's happening on a day-to-day basis in the schools as a result of their inability to solve this doesn't seem to be bothering them on a day-to-day basis, or something that the school year is half over, and kids have already gone through the bulk of the college application system without enough counselors to help them. And, you know, nobody seems to be saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, sitting down and saying, we've got to solve this somehow.
Well, jump on.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I just wanted to jump on both that point and Kristen talking about Kensington Kappa, because when you talk about the Philadelphia School District, it's almost two school districts, especially at the high school level. We're talking about the comprehensive neighborhood high schools that have to take everybody, and then the ones that I can be more selective. And those schools are certainly hurting, right? But they're going to get by. Those kids have the infrastructure.
What are we talking, Central?
We're talking about Central, we're talking about Masterman, we're talking about GAMP, right? Those kids are going to be able to get by. Those teachers and guidance counselors are going to scramble to make things happen, but it's at the neighborhood high school level where you have the homelessness, you have the transients, you have the kids that were rejected from other schools or couldn't make it in a certain charter school. And when cuts come down the line, those are the kids that get hurt the most.
Well, Kristen, let me pick up on that, because you wrote about the shortage of counselors in the school district, including at Central. There are two full-time counselors for 2,400 students. I think there used to be eight, according to your reporting.
At one point, there was kind of an influx of counselors under former Superintendent Ackerman, and as the money dried up, those folks were let go, and now the ratios are really dismal. And, you know, my story in particular touched on college counseling, which Dale alluded to. You know, this is really crunch time. A lot of the more selective colleges' applications were due January 1st, some were due January 15th, but, you know, I talked to a number of counselors, some of whom said, you know, I just couldn't get it all done. And these are people who, you know, I talked to one counselor on New Year's Eve, and he said, this is how I'm spending my New Year's Eve, writing letters of recommendation and sending out things. You know, and some counselors said, you know, I just, despite my best efforts and working nights and weekends, I had to call some colleges and say, I submitted a day late for, you know, such and such's early decision application because there's just not enough time.
Well, in fact, you reported there's a two-week waiting list to see a counselor.
At Central High, there's a two-week waiting list. Northeast High, the city's largest school, has 3,000 kids, two full-time and two part-time counselors.
And I don't want to undercut the struggles that happen at schools like Central because, you know, Tatiana Almeida, the counselor at Central, told me, you know, when we have to deal with college applications, and this is the deadline here, all the other problems just kind of fall down the wayside. And she talks specifically about when freshmen come into a school like Central, they come from all over the city, and they're not used to this very high-pressure environment, and they usually have to deal with these problems somehow, and the counselors just haven't been able to deal with those sort of problems.
Yeah. Dale, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, kids go through mental health crises in schools, and they have all kinds of other issues that they have to deal with, and this falls on the counselors a lot, and it's very hard for them, even with a full complement, to deal with college counseling and all the other issues relating to that, to their duties relating to special education, and, you know, and it's just 100% harder now to try to do all that.
Is there some kind of urgency, Kristen, to get more counselors into the school, or perhaps use teachers differently, of course, knowing that they have a lot to do, or bringing in volunteers to help
out? I mean, different schools have partnerships with different organizations who have provided resources, and that's certainly a help. But again, that's all speaks to the, you know, the principal or the community's ability to bring in those resources. And, you know, certainly teachers are doing much more to act as counselors. I mean, they always have, but in times when, you know, the staff isn't there, you know, teachers are stepping up. The principal of Kensington Kappa, when I spent the day there, said that she believed about 95% of what they do and the problems they have are kids' emotional issues. And so this is enormous. You know, we talk about tests and standards, and those are very important, but you can't learn unless, you know, you feel safe and you know, your emotional health is adequate.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here. I mean, has safety been an issue this year, Kevin? In terms of incidents,
I think that there's been anecdotal evidence of many incidents reported. It hasn't been maybe the gigantic tumultuous mess that some people had predicted, especially with school closings and, you know, people going from one neighborhood to the other and all that. I don't think that's played out to the extent that maybe it was hyped to be, but there's certainly been incidents, and the understaffed nature of the school certainly makes that more difficult to deal with.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're getting an update on what's been happening in the Philadelphia School District, talking with Kevin McCrory, who covers education for Newsworks and for WHYY. Dale Mezzacapa, she is the contributing editor at the Philadelphia Public School Notebook, sharing partnership with WHYY, and with Kristen Graham. She's education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, in fact, won a Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for her reporting. We have State Representative Brendan Boyle waiting in the wings. I know he wants to add to our conversation. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Pennsylvania Med-Ed program, offering master's level training in education, scholarship, and technology for physicians and healthcare professionals. A collaboration between physician educators and education professionals, it's an executive-style program designed to enable students to earn a degree in 2 years using on-site intensives and online learning. More information about the University of Pennsylvania Med-Ed program at gse.upenn.edu/med-ed.
Next time on The Pulse, it seems like two old friends getting together. But one woman is an oncology nurse, the other is dying.
I have been fighting cancer for 5 years, and it has been an uphill battle.
Joanna Little is done fighting, but not done living.
Next Friday, I'm taking my oldest back to college.
Changing end-of-life care.
How have you been?
Didn't she tell you I'm the Energizer Bunny now?
No, you didn't tell me that.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Philomena is a hit film, but the real-life woman who had a child taken away for adoption can't forget the last image of him over 50 years ago.
All I could see was a little face at the back of the window looking out, and I'm looking down the window thinking, oh my God, he's gone.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, it's a roundtable with three reporters who cover Philadelphia schools, Kevin McCrory, Kristen Graham, and Dale Mazzacapa. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Representative Brendan Boyle to join our conversation. Good morning, and nice to have you with us. And I understand you just had a little baby.
Yes, that's right.
Not you personally, but your wife, I guess.
Yeah, that's probably an important clarification.
It is,
but we're very happy to say our baby girl is exactly 1 week old this morning.
So. Well, congratulations on that. I know you're going to introduce a bill dealing with this counselor situation. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I actually introduced this in November, in large part because I was hearing so many community complaints in September about this school counselor crisis. The fact that we have so few school counselors, in fact, at one point over the summer, we actually had zero, until at least $45 million was restored to the Philadelphia School District, every single school counselor was laid off in Philadelphia. We are now at the most bare-bones sort of situation, so my bill simply would mandate what is the nationally accepted standard that in elementary schools you have one counselor for every 375 students maximum, and that in high school particularly you have one counselor for a maximum of every 325 students. The situation in Philadelphia right now and some of the other distressed school districts is that you only have one counselor for 1,500 students or 2,000 students, or two counselors for 2,400.
Right.
We are so far beyond what is the accepted guideline, it's not even close.
Well,
and it's a very deeply concerning situation.
I'm curious about the response you've gotten from Harrisburg.
Well, needless to say, the climate in Harrisburg is not exactly what I would call pro-education or pro-Philadelphia. A lot of these problems, not all of them, but a lot of these problems were created by the billion-dollar cuts to public education over the last 3 years to begin with. I would say, though, the fact that you now see a governor and some folks starting to pay a political price because of these deep cuts. My hope is, and the conversations I've had with, I'm a Democrat, I've had conversations with folks on the other side who seem to be supportive, is that even they recognize there has to be some restoration of some of these cuts, and this would be a reasonable place to start.
Let me see if I can get a response. Kristen, do you want to respond to what State Representative Boyle just said?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think that the counselor cut has really hit hard. You know, schools have lost tons of things, but that's one thing when you talk to parents, teachers, people in schools, you know, it's really a stark cut because, you know, we have to provide for kids' emotional needs.
Kevin, anything you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, that's a definite point. When we talk about the funding in Harrisburg, I guess one of the things that we always and education advocates always point to is we have a constitutional mandate to be thorough and efficient. And what does that mean, to be thorough and efficient?
Good
education
question.
That's very debatable, right? And Dale was talking earlier about all these standards and standardized tests and Common Core. So we have these mandates to meet certain things, but are we providing the funding to be able to say we're going to get you to proficient, and whatever proficient means?
You want to weigh in on that, Dale? Then we'll get a response from you, Representative Boyle.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the representative, and how is that going to be enforced? Because the issue of, you know, there's one issue when we're talking about school funding, which is to meet a mandate or threshold, thorough and efficient education. It's another to actually provide the money that the form,
right.
Even if there is a formula, which Pennsylvania doesn't really have, it's another thing to provide the money that actually makes it happen. So, you know, the enforceability, and, you know, you're going to force, how are you going to say to us, what are you going to do if a school district doesn't hire the counselors?
That's a good question. Yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, in all honesty, my main motivation for making this a statewide mandate and putting it part of the school code is to ensure that the state has to fund it. So there is a protection in the bill, and similar to what exists in other states, whereby this would become, since it's a state mandate, the state would be required to fund this and provide resources. So this would help in school districts like Philadelphia, but also others, where they've cut the school counselors to the point where almost all of them were laid off. Because I agree, I mean, if you have a mandate on paper, you don't provide the funding, then you really haven't achieved anything. The funding part has to come with it.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. State Representative Brendan Boyle joining our conversation in this hour of Radio Times. And you can join us as well. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499, especially if you send a child to school here in Philadelphia, have some kind of association or affiliation with the school district or other schools in the city. You can give us a call again, 1-888-477-9499. Kevin, let me go back to you. Where does the PFT union contract negotiate? Where does that stand today?
It stands the same place it did on September 1st, the day after the contract expired. It seems like it's gone nowhere.
Are there negotiations?
Negotiations continue. They continue to go to negotiations. I guess they've ramped them up a little bit recently. I don't know exactly what that means when they say that. But, Jerry Jordan throughout, throughout the summer and throughout, and he's the leader of the PFT, of course, throughout the fall said, last time we had a contract, it wasn't resolved until January, so... We've all been thinking maybe it'll be this January, but it could be February, it could be March.
And we're talking about, Kristen, givebacks and work rules. I mean, some pretty important issues.
Absolutely.
On the table.
Some of the proposals, the district's initial proposals, were leaked last year, and there were just, you know, really fundamental shifts that were proposed, of course, in salary, up to, I think, 14% cut in salary. And, you know, that was an initial contract proposal. Take that into consideration and benefit givebacks as well. But I think the bigger shifts were really in work rules, because you would look at, you know, removal of, you know, a lot of things that the union has traditionally held on to, in terms of how teachers are placed in schools. You know, some of those have already gone by the wayside because the School Reform Commission suspended parts of the public school codes, and teachers have been assigned a little differently this year, but, really big changes.
But I'm assuming, Dale, it's possible to not have a contract and just not have a contract.
Well, yeah. I mean, the status quo, I guess from the union's point of view, is better than what the district wants. And, you know, Jerry Jordan did say early on that the union was willing to make some benefit concessions. I mean, most members of the PFT do not pay toward their premiums, and that's pretty much not the case for almost everyone else right now. So, but the idea of getting major changes in the contract along the lines that Kristen was describing are things that are really worth discussing could be beneficial, and, you know, it's time to revisit these things. But usually when you do that, you offer something in return, and right now the district, the SRC, the state is basically saying, no, we want you to take pay cuts on top of this. And not only that, but they're doing something very interesting, which is to say, when we're looking at sources of revenue or sources of income for the school district, you know, there's the state and the city that give it money, and then there's the compensation package from the district. You know, this is another source of revenue, and you have to play your part, which is kind of an interesting way to look at it. So they're really asking for a whole lot all at once.
When we have this conversation too, it's important, I think, to look at the greater context. This is the consequence of us making education a market-based system, right? If you have charter schools, which are public schools, that can have certain rules for their teachers and pay certain prices and have certain contracts, it's just going to force the district's hand to say, how are we going to compete with this school? If the kids are leaving, 30,000 kids have left to go to charter schools in the past 5 years, we have to change something. We have to figure something out. That's partly their motivation in saying, well, we need to make these changes to our contract. Now, the teachers say, hey, is that fair?
Do you see that the charter school, the move to charter schools has then put pressure on the PFT, I guess other members of the district, to make concessions?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the move to charter schools has sort of redefined the whole district. It's definitely touched everything and has just changed the way kids are educated in Philadelphia.
And it has the largest number of charter schools in the state, yes?
Absolutely.
It has half the charter schools in all the in Pennsylvania. Yeah. And I think we need to also look at the issue of charter school funding and how that works and how district funding works. And right now, it doesn't work really well because the district has to give money to the charters. It's one of the biggest items in their budget right now.
The money follows the children, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, the way the charter school law works, along with the funding system that the state has, is that the money goes to charters based on the number of students they have, whereas the state formula really doesn't put a, for want of a better word, a price on each student. So, and, you know, ultimately, they do put a price on each student for the charter schools, but ultimately when the per pupil cost is reduced in Philadelphia because the overall amount of money is reduced, that then impacts the charter schools as well. But the charter law and the school code and the funding process are working sort of the worst of all possible worlds right now in terms of certainly the district. There hasn't been a recognition, for instance, that the district incurs any cost when kids go to charters. The idea has been, you know, they should just have downsized. But there's a lot of kids who come into charters who never went to public schools. And then, you know, so it's a very complex system. And again, there seems to be a lot of antagonism, a lot of gridlock in Harrisburg. And even though, obviously, Philadelphia is affected more than any other school district by charter legislation, I don't see any evidence that there's important Philadelphia people at the table in terms of when the charter law is being, or a revision of the charter law, which hasn't happened since it went into effect 16 years ago, is being moved along.
And you did a whole show recently with Anthony Hardy Williams,
yes,
right,
who has a plan
sponsoring this legislation, right? And the question, kind of, to boil his plan down, is who should have the authority to say we're going to grow charter schools or we're going to create new ones or let more kids go to them? Right now, that's up to the school district,
right?
And you could argue that the school district doesn't really have the power to put the limits on that they would like. His plan would allow. Hey,
universities,
you're Temple University. You want to authorize a charter school? Go for it.
But the tension, the tension in who should authorize, whether they should be allowed to expand, is a direct result of this kind of dysfunctional funding system. That means that the more the district turns over, if they have no control over the growth of charter schools under the current system, they cannot plan at all for their own financial future because they just don't know how much money. And the other thing that's going on is that the charter schools, you know, basically build the district, and the district has had some disputes with them over whether they're actually educating the kids they say they are. And, you know, that hasn't been resolved either, you know, to really take a hard look at all that. So there's a lot of antagonism being created that could be avoided if everyone decided that they were, you know, going to try to work it out.
And work together.
And again, no urgency.
Well, and let me just quickly reintroduce the three. I just want to make sure that our listeners are keeping up with who was talking about what. The voice you just heard, Dale Mezzacapa, she's the contributing editor of the Philadelphia Public School Notebook, which shares a partnership with WHYY. Kevin McCrory covers education for Newsworks.org and WHYY. And Kristen Graham is education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We do have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. Kristen, you wanted to say something before I pounced on you there.
Yeah, Dale had sort of alluded to the antagonism, and there is a fair amount of antagonism between the charter and the district community. And something you hear a lot from the charter folks is that there have been no new charter schools other than Renaissance schools, which are district schools that the district chooses to give to charters. So there have been no new standalone charters created for several years, and that's a function of the district's budget crisis. So there's just a lot at play. It's funding. It's, you know, whether charters are going to be able to expand. And the district oversight of charters is considered by many to be really lackluster. I think there are, you know, some startling number, like four or six people.
More than six. Certainly.
In the district's charter school office, and they oversee dozens and dozens of schools.
And thousands of children, obviously.
And millions of dollars. So it's really kind of startling.
Kevin, I do want to have you talk about the cyber school reporting that you have done, but hold on to that only because I do want to get some callers in. And we have, looks like Cynthia from Queen Village. And Cynthia, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was employed by the school district for 28 years. I was laid off in June. I have a daughter who's a senior. She's in the public schools. Fortunately, she's in one of the good schools that Kevin was talking about. So it's been, although it's been rough for us with the counseling and trying to get her into colleges, I'm certain it's not as rough as it has been for some of the other families who don't have the information that we've been lucky enough to have. However, my question and my concern is about the families who don't have access, primarily our bilingual families, or not necessarily bilingual, the monolingual families, who are not getting these services, who no longer have access, and don't have someone advocating for them to gain access to this information. So I'm just wondering if you can address that and talk about what's being done. Thank you. I'll take my call, Thea.
Cynthia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kristen, can you take that?
Sure. Cynthia makes a really good point, and that goes back to the lack of staff in schools. Cynthia was laid off in June, and a lot of the folks who were laid off did those really vital ground-level things like bilingual counseling assistants. There are folks who translate for people who don't speak English or people whose first language is not English. And, you know, anecdotally, you hear from parents and advocates for, you know, kids who have special ed needs and kids who don't speak English, that the services really just are lackluster. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if classes are larger and the resources aren't there, you know, these are often the kids who suffer the most because there's no one to help them. And it's not, you know, the fault of a teacher who, you know, if you have 33 kids in a class and you know, kids are in different places academically, you just can't get to everything.
The special ed piece of this is just maybe even the most critical, right? I mean, these are the most vulnerable kids. And unless their parents are really tigers, right, and know who to go after and know who to advocate to, they're going to fall through the cracks.
Mm. We have an email. I'm going to toss this to you, Dale. Why hasn't anyone filed a civil rights lawsuit against the district for not meeting the kids' needs?
Well, that's interesting. That is one option, you know, filing this lawsuit against the school district, but there's also talk now. Most states that have school funding formulas that are based on need and based on enrollment, there's been lots of lawsuits in like 45 states. Pennsylvania has had lawsuits in the past, but they have been unsuccessful, and largely because the courts here have decided that school funding is a legislative prerogative. The legislature has the right to decide what thorough efficient is, and the legislature has the right to decide when it's not being met. But there is now talk, because of the dire situation that not only Philadelphia but other school districts in the state are finding themselves in, of reviving some kind of a lawsuit. Mm. There's federal civil rights, there's state lawsuit. Usually it's against the state. So it'll be interesting to see whether, you know, if there was a civil rights lawsuit filed against the school district, you know, would it just be against the school? There's a long history of litigation in trying to decide, you know, and involve the courts in getting adequate education mm-hmm. to students in Philadelphia, and none of them have ever been successful.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but I'm assuming rural districts are also dealing with some of the same issues that a city district like Philadelphia.
Yeah, the major lawsuit that was brought in Pennsylvania was brought by rural school districts, and that was the decision in which it was made that it was a legislative prerogative. And yeah, there's a lot of rural districts, and some, you know, some mm-hmm. inner, like suburban districts, you know, not as affluent as some others, have also been cutting back and raising taxes and, you know.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the Philadelphia School District. Halfway through the school year, began certainly over the summer, leading into the opening of the schools in September, a very chaotic, tumultuous time. Children are in classrooms. Teachers are trying to teach, but many questions and issues about the stresses of teaching in Philadelphia. Talking with Dale Mezzacapa, Kevin McCrory, and Kristen Graham. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-7-7-9-4-9-9. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, the music of Tchaikovsky, the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra. The January Tchaikovsky Festival begins as Stephen Huff performs the first piano concerto and Robin Tacciotti conducts the Fourth Symphony. Tchaikovsky tickets at 215-893-1999 or online at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, the music of Tchaikovsky with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
On the next Fresh Air.
Boys, the one and only Mrs. P.L. Travers, the creator of our beloved Mary
Poppins.
Who else?
Mary Poppins.
Emma Thompson tells us about playing the author of Mary Poppins, P.L. Travers, in the new film Saving Mr. Banks. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Lost boys to responsible men in South Sudan.
Joseph Akolmakir came here in 2003 with four younger siblings, all orphans.
A woman from Fargo, North Dakota reflects on the current unrest in South Sudan and the people she's worked with and helped for nearly a decade. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. It's been a tumultuous year for children attending schools run by the Philadelphia School District. Staff has been laid off. Schools have been closed. The union contract with teachers has not been signed. The district still faces some serious budget problems and is looking for a new chief of the School Reform Commission. Talking with Kevin McCrory, who reports for WHYY's Newsworks, for Kristen Graham, who writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Dale Mezzacapa, contributing editor at the Philadelphia Public School Notebook. Kevin, you did a story about cyber charter schools. And help, first of all, help us understand, what is a cyber charter school?
Cyber charter school is a school where kid learns from their home via computer, via the internet, and they're interacting with a virtual teacher who's sitting in some other building somewhere else. But when we talk about charter schools in general, both cybers and brick-and-mortar charters, we need to acknowledge that they've done some amazing things for kids in the city. They've opened up more options. They've given kids a better opportunity. Cyber education is very debatable, though, about how effective it's been. The numbers aren't good.
In fact, the numbers are bad.
The numbers are bad. And so then you would think, and then when you get into the financial conversation of it, you would think that you would be saving more money because you don't have to pay, you pay fewer teachers, you don't have to pay building costs, you don't have to mow the lawn, right? You don't have to pay the heating bill. And just the way it's structured in Pennsylvania, that's just not the case, right? When a student leaves, say, the Philadelphia School District to go to a brick-and-mortar charter school, they get X amount of money. When they leave to go to the cyber charter school, they get the same amount of money. And, you know, and then what's interesting, too, is a cyber charter can take kids from anywhere in the state. So if a kid goes from Lower Merion,
they get more money.
Yeah, they're going to send $17,000 about. When they come from Philadelphia, they're going to get about $8,000. Same kid, same cyber education. Completely different price tag, right?
So what do they do with all the money? I mean, obviously they're educating students, but it sounds like there's money
that's
left
very debatable.
Over.
That's very debatable, yeah. So they do run up, typically they run up larger surpluses. They tend, and it's alleged that they use this money to maybe fund some of their more national programs. They spend more money on advertising. They would defend this idea, and it's definitely worthwhile for schools to run up surpluses in times of crisis, right? You want to have that stuff in the bank account. You want to be able to serve your kids to the best ability as you can. So there's no school that's going to say, give us less money.
Right.
They're going
right.
to find a way to spend it.
What do you think, Dale? Well, how do you see this?
Yeah, well, cyber charters, like Kevin said, they spend money on different things. And most of them in Pennsylvania, which is the most cyber-friendly state in the country, are run by for-profit companies. So in Pennsylvania, charter schools have to be nonprofit, but they can contract with for-profits. And I think the model for most of the charter schools is the cyber charter schools is to do that. So, you know, and it's also harder, like when a Philadelphia student or Lower Merion student goes off to a cyber, enrolls in a cyber school, it's not that easy to track it down. And maybe, you know, they're also paying for that student to be in another school. And, you know, by the time they sort it all out. And so the school district established its own cyber school this year in an effort to lure away from the cyber charters some of the students who feel that they want that kind of an education, and they've got about 200 students or so now, which saves them money because they are now educating them themselves.
We have some sixth grade students at Overbrook Educational Center listening to us, and Kristen, from one of the students, if Mr. Hite, the superintendent, runs the school district, then what is he doing to help the students and staff of the Philadelphia schools run smoothly? I had a question, sort of like the sixth grade student, about...
It's a very good question,
It's a very
graders.
Good question, and which is, how is he viewed What is his vision? Has he been able to implement any parts of the vision that he brought to the city?
Well, I think by and large, Dr. Hite is viewed very positively from people from a lot of different sectors. I think people would say he's doing a really good job in really, really tough circumstances. But, you know, as to what he's been able to accomplish, well, I mean, this is a situation like no other. I mean, he's, you know, he did lay out a vision, and, you know, a lot of, you're not, look, in this environment, you're not going to be able to grow and implement terrific new programs. There has been, you know, some innovation that he, you know, he was behind the Philadelphia School District's virtual school. It's not a charter. It's right. It's a cyber program. But, you know, basically it's been all crisis all the time. The budget, the PFT contract, things like that. I mean, there's really not much to do but, you know, just lead through the crisis right now.
Do you think a superintendent has to be feared and loved, or loved and feared, or one or the other, Dale?
No, I don't think he or she has to be feared necessarily. I think that, like Kristen said, Hite has a good reputation. He's unflappable. He is a traditional educator. Although he did go to the Broad Academy, he came up through the ranks. He started out as a teacher, a superintendent, and he ran. He was in the Prince George's School District outside of D.C. I think in coming to Pennsylvania, you know, Philadelphia is unique, and certainly in the state and maybe anywhere, in that the people who run the district have no control whatsoever over the revenue generation and how much money they have to spend. And I think that that fact and a realization that, you know, just how little clout Philadelphia has and how little control it has, I think has, you know, he's still reeling from that, I think, and trying his best, certainly, to navigate it all, and he's always putting a good face on things, you know, he does try in that respect.
Just to get at the question too, yes. You know, he has a reputation as a listener, right? People feel like they can go to him and he'll understand their issue, right. And whether or not he can do something to make better, I think it does make people feel better compared to some of the superintendents in the past that he's actually caring.
Well, our thanks to the sixth grade students at Overbrook Educational Center for the questions and obviously for listening to the show as well. Kevin, can you talk a bit about the fact that there is an opening at the School Reform Commission for the top job?
So, yeah, Pedro Ramos stepped down in, I guess it was November,
October.
Yeah. And it's been kept vacant since then. There's been meetings. They've been run by, at this point, the interim SRC chair, Wendell Pritchett. And we've been waiting, just like everybody else, to find out who that's going to be. There's been some murmuring here and there of our own city councilman, Bill Green. There's been some other names put forward. Joseph Duretsky will also be stepping down this month. So there's now two vacancies potentially that need to be filled.
And these are vacancies that get filled by the governor, right?
They do.
They have agreement.
They have to be approved by the legislature.
Kristen, anything you want to add to that? And I do want to get back to our callers.
I think, you know, the fact that the SRC has been operating without a chair since October 23rd is you know, kind of speaks to, we talked about, is there a lot of urgency in Harrisburg? And the governor has said, you know, I understand the urgency, want to get the right person for the job, but we're going into budget season and we really need someone to lead the SRC. And, you know, you got to wonder, is the governor having a hard time finding someone to take this enormous job?
And it is indeed enormous and very difficult job as well. Let me see what Rich from Havertown has to say. Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. This is Rich McGlory. And first, I want to thank Kristen and Dale and Mr. McCrory for your excellent reporting on this.
Great.
And I call, first of all, as an administrator and a teacher for 34 years, and I worked at Furnace High School in a situation which we were overwhelmed when Paul Vallis closed Auden Reed and sent us 300 students without any additional resources, that I don't think people can really appreciate the stress on schools that the understaffing creates. It affects people emotionally. It affects their physical health. It burns everyone out, students, staff. It is just intolerable situation.
Well, Rich, I want to thank you for calling into Radio Times, and I think sort of underscoring what we've been talking about. But, Kevin, you know, a real-life teacher, a retired teacher, saying how difficult it is to deal with all these stresses and changes.
And you find that, I think, across the board everywhere. It's an extremely stressful job that is hard in normal times. You're talking about trying to raise people from reading levels or grade levels that are already far below, right, and trying to get them to be achieving at much higher rates. And how do you do that in normal times?
Indeed. We have an email from Beth. Seems like there should be a closer partnership between the city, private organizations, and the district. This is a city problem, and private organizations could give back. Dale, I know Philadelphia Futures, for instance, working with Northeast High, Kristen,
right,
had talked about in terms of helping some of these kids get into college.
Well, there are many, 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 many partnerships between the school district and nonprofit organizations and businesses adopt schools, and Philadelphia Futures is focused on helping students get into college. So there are many partnerships. Other issues relating to, like, for instance, the business community, should they be more actively involved in the funding situation, in laying out the issues, in the, you know, is this fair, is this adequate, you know, how do we determine need, and, you know, that there are questions to be raised, I think, in that regard. But there are many, many partnerships. On the other hand, while these are all beneficial and good, you know, you shouldn't be depending on, you know, charity for basic services, which the district has sort of done this year, that should be provided as part of the mandate to educate all children in the Commonwealth.
Did you want to add something, Kristen?
Definitely. I think Dale's point is a good one. And traditionally, I think it's important to note that a lot of private organizations have been slow to work with the district because the district has thrown up some bureaucratic hurdles. You know, if you want to go and donate, you know, some either money or a service, you know, often the district has made it really tough to work with individual schools.
But why is that? What's the thinking behind that?
It's a large bureaucracy. There's a lot of, you know, this is the way we've already always done this. You know, I don't know who I would talk to at, you know, the district central headquarters. One thing Dr. Height and his team have tried to do is to sort of break down those barriers and make it easier for organizations to reach out.
Let me see what Hayward from Northern Liberties has to say. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
How you doing today?
Good. Good. Go ahead.
Good, good. Yes, what I wanted to add was that I've actually met with City Council about putting out new revenue arms for the school district, but they can't seem to think out of the box because of the bureaucracy that is behind it. We've met with constituents from Dr. Height who agrees, but, you know, this is such a large problem. They're sitting in a building that they lease, that they only occupy maybe 40% of it, and they're not even allowed to lease out and rent out the rest of the space to create revenue or even introduce the revenue arms that we introduced to City Council for them.
Well, that's interesting. I know the district is trying to sell off buildings, I guess, with City Council's looking at that as well. But is there real estate, I guess, that can be used or rented or...
Well, I think the caller is alluding to the district central headquarters. It's known as 440. It's at 440 North Broad, and 440 is definitely underutilized. There's been some talk about selling it from the community, and the SRC has essentially said, you know, not really worth our time. There's a lot of debt on the building. Wouldn't be worth it. Mm-hmm. But there has been, I've heard talk in the past of doing innovative things like locating a school there, but it really hasn't gone anywhere. That is a prime piece of real estate, especially as that North Broad corridor really develops and gets to be a hot spot.
And the staff has been reduced, has it not, Dale, of the administrative staff in the district?
By a lot. In fact, the joke is that 440 is really 220
or 110,
you know, because the central staff has really been cut back substantially. And to the caller's point, the district should be using its buildings as efficiently as possible, but doing that would not solve the larger issue.
A couple minutes before we have to say goodbye here, and Kevin, we're at the beginning of 2014. I guess the district is in the process of putting together some kind of a budget for next year. How do you think that looks to them?
It's going to be just the same. It's going to be a repeat of last year, right, but with more stresses. The contract, as Kristen was saying earlier, still is not in place. We have more of these demands, and I don't know what's going to happen, but it's certainly not going to be pretty.
Dale?
I would just remind everyone that technically right now the district's budget is balanced, right? So any money they get would be about restoring things. But the other point to make is that the money that it has received, that it had asked for, the original $300 million package that it had wanted, the money it's gotten through the state and the city has basically, they're all one shot.
Yeah.
So absent, I don't know how they're going to put a budget together, actually, because I don't know how they're going to be able to determine what they actually have, compounded, of course, by the fact that they have not gotten the labor savings that they were hoping for. It would seem that there would at least be some urgency to settle the contract before the budget season starts. But the you know, the extension of the sales tax, cigarette tax, property sales, none of these, well, property sales wouldn't even be recurring, but, you know, the recurring sources of revenue have not been agreed upon. And again, you know, budget season starts. Yeah. It's starting soon.
I'm giving you the last word, Kristen.
Well, I you know, to Dale's point, I'm hearing that the contract is just nowhere near settled. So that's you know, a huge thing, and it's going to have implications that, you know, reach far into the future.
Something like $100 million or potentially $100
million? $100 million is what the...
Over a five-year period?
Is what the district is looking for in givebacks from the PFT.
Just to put point on that, I mean, we're talking about educating kids in poverty. We're talking about trying to raise the revenue doing that from families that are in poverty. There's a fundamental conflict there, right? So how's that going to change without more funding from a wider tax base of the state?
On that note, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times, helping us to understand what's been happening in the Philadelphia School District. Kevin McCrory, thank you very much. He covers education for Newsworks and for WHYY. Dale Mazzacapa, thank you very much as well. And she's the contributing editor at the Philadelphia Public School Notebook, sharing partnership with WHYY. And Kristen Graham, thank you very much as well. And she is education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Won a Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for her reporting. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our homepage, you can carry on a conversation there. Check us out also for Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, and satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.